From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It's impossible and pointless to say whether World War II would have played out the way it did if Hitler hadn't written his book Mein Kampf in 1924. But the historian Peter Ross Range says that book and that year was the point when the arc of Hitler's trajectory bends. He was in prison for trying to overthrow the German government. He was sitting in a cell, and that gave him time to brood and to think and to write. Range is joining us today. He says the book helped Hitler shift his focus. It hardened his beliefs. It became his preview for the Third Reich. Mein Kampf was banned in Germany after the war, but the copyright expired, which has given us the opportunity to talk about the book and the year it was written and what it actually says. Join us after the news.
Whether you're new to the state or a native Utahn, some of you may wonder, why should I care about what goes on during the legislative session? Issues are being debated by both officials and the public with a passion not seen in years. Find out more about what's happening and how it affects you. Check out KUER's new podcast, 45 Days, on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, and at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In many ways, 1924 could have been, maybe should have been, the worst year of Adolf Hitler's life. That was the year he spent in the Landsberg prison for his part in the attempt to overthrow the German government in a beer hall. It was clearly a defeat for Hitler and a small radical group of Nazis, but the historian Peter Ross Range says prison turned out to be the best thing that could have happened to him. Range says if Hitler hadn't spent those 13 months in prison, he might never have emerged as the redefined and recharged politician who took hold of Germany. And Range calls 1924 the hinge moment for Hitler, and the product of all that brooding and thinking, of course, was his book, Mein Kampf. The book was banned in Germany after the war, but the copyright expired, which has given us an opportunity to talk about it with Peter Ross Range. He is a former foreign correspondent of Time magazine, a former White House correspondent for U.S. News and World Report, and his book is called 1924, The Year That Made Hitler. He's joining us today from a studio in Washington, D.C. Peter Ross Range, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with
us. Thank you. Thank you.
You say in the book that when you're – a lot of people, when they talk about Hitler, they sort of explore his life. There's an awful lot of emphasis on that time that he takes power in 1933 and then, you know, 1945 when he kills himself. You say the real critical years, though, for you anyway, in understanding Hitler in many ways, are the 14 years leading up to 1933 when he takes power. Would you talk about that? How do you see those as being really critical? Because I guess those are the times that really formed the way he's thinking about all of this.
That's right, and it helps us understand what was going on in Germany at that time during the Weimar Republic, during the hyperinflation, later on during the Depression. And it shows us what set Hitler on the course that eventually became the Third Reich and unfolded as a war and as the Holocaust. And my interest was in this turning point in 1924, after he had spent 4 years as a radical revolutionary, refused to take part in the parliamentary democracy, denounced democracy as a joke, and then during this time in prison realized the only way to power for him was going to be through the democratic system.
Yeah.
So that's why it became a pivotal moment in his development. Otherwise, he might never have made it to the top.
So interesting. He hated democracy, though. that he has to use that as a mechanism to get there is kind of ironic, I guess.
Well, he thought it was a weak, ineffectual system, and it is true that the German democracy, the first real German democracy, wasn't working very well. Mm-hmm. They were into their ninth cabinet in the first 5 years by the time Hitler staged his putsch, and they kept changing governments, changing leaders without much success, and the economy was going down, unemployment was going up. All kinds of horrible things were happening, and 1923 was indeed the annus horribilis, the worst year of all, the most horrible year of these 14 years. And it's not really surprising once one reads into the detailed circumstances as I outlined in my book, why it came to a putsch in November of 1923.
Yeah. The Bavarian government, of course, put Mein Kampf, the book that's the product of his 13 months in prison, they put it under wraps, as you say in your book, after the war, held on to it, of course, for seven decades. And you mention in the book how Mein Kampf becomes both forbidden fruit and demonized detritus of the worst period of German history. We'll dig into that as we go along, but would you give us a sense of what you make of kind of the taboo that book has become, the resistance people have to really touching it or even opening it in some cases?
Well, it's very interesting. On the one hand, it was easily available on the internet for the past 15 or 20 years.
Yeah.
It could even be had in Germany in used bookstores from time to time. And in many families, there was a legacy copy from the grandparents or in the attic somewhere. Mm-hmm. And yet people, nobody had much interest in it, for one thing. And
right.
For another thing, it was considered toxic. You know, you just couldn't quite touch it. And for people who were adamantly opposed to its republication, particularly members of the Jewish Holocaust survivor community, yeah. understandably, who felt that it was just too much to expect them to put up with that, it was almost as if the book was part of Hitler's body. There was something corporeal about it, it seemed. And that the evil that he begat could come back through that book. That was the nature of the resistance to it. And this was part of what the publishers, the academic institution in Munich, wanted to overcome by publishing it and surrounding it with footnotes. The footnotes are longer than the actual text,
right.
by a few hundred pages. They felt they could demythologize it and show it for what it was, which is a sort of a wild and crazy screed. In some places, and other places, simply a discussion of various public policies, but of course shot through with anti-Semitism and with the prospect of violence and war.
You know, I was having a conversation with one of our producers yesterday about the book, and he said, you know, it's funny that we don't translate the title in this country into English. It's Mein Kampf, almost as if that would give it some other kind of power to give it a... You know what I mean? I wonder, have you ever thought about that?
That's interesting. It is, of course, in the official translations, it is called My Struggle or
right.
My Battle in English. But you're right. Commonly, we refer to it as Mein Kampf, and everybody knows what you mean. Well, this was part of the genius of the publisher and of Hitler at the time when they shortened what had been a very long title in Hitler's original planning to a very short, punchy title, Mein Kampf. His original title was something like My 4.5 Years of Struggle Against Cowardice, Lies, and Bad Guys, A Reckoning.
Right.
It was a 7 or 10 word title. And finally, at the end, one of the guys in the publishing house said, wait a minute, let's just call it Mein Kampf, which, of course, was an ingenious choice, as
yeah.
you've just pointed out, Doug.
Yeah. The question, of course, and you mentioned this early on in your book, the question that continues to baffle people, of course, is how it is that this unschooled army private in World War I manages to turn himself into this mesmerizing leader of millions. Do you think writing as you did about this really critical period in Adolf Hitler's life, do you have a sense of what it was that was so compelling about that loud little man, as some called him?
Well, I think it's a two-sided coin. It has to do with German society at the time, and
yeah.
then on the other hand, with this particular person. The situation in Germany in those years was worse than I realized. I mean, we all know the basic story of the Weimar Republic, but when you start reading into it in detail, you begin to appreciate how desperate they were, having lost a war, having lost territory, having 2 million of their young men killed. And the economic slide that followed from it, Europe in some ways in dissolution, the Habsburg monarchy falling apart, much worse situation than we can imagine today. And then having not an imagined but a real Marxist threat from the East. The Russian Revolution had just occurred shortly before the end of World War I. And so and Hitler's big pitch, really his number one pitch, was anti-Marxism, anti-Semitism.
Yeah.
Came second for a while. And this had a certain appeal. And then there was, on top of that, it comes the personality of the guy who was absolutely fearless about his ability to stir people up. So he was the strongman leader in a very bad situation with a big pair of lungs, and he took total advantage of it. He also had a genius for mass psychology.
Yeah.
He knew how to keep things simple, how to dumb things down, how to appeal to mass emotions, and even draw in not just the raving mobs, but some educated people as well. And under those circumstances, what he had to say seemed to make a lot of sense to a lot of people over time.
Yeah.
I should, go back to what you said. This was a 14-year period we're talking about.
Right.
And the flex point was 1924, as I say, while he was in prison, while he was writing this book. But in those last 8 years, he managed to broaden his appeal beyond just the masses.
There are it's interesting, in your book, you have some of the images taken by the photographer Heinrich Hoffmann of Hitler striking these poses, which gets at what you were just saying about he had a real instinct for how to give a speech and how to really stir up the masses. This was very practiced for him, the way he spoke, the way he shaped his body, posed his body, I guess. That was all part of the act, I guess.
That's right, and it's right in Mein Kampf, not the pictures, but the explanation.
He criticized
your standard garden variety middle-of-the-road politician for sounding like old professors who were putting people to sleep, and he was right about that in many cases, and explained why it was necessary to reach to the hearts of people, not just to the heads. He instinctively understood what masses of flags and uniforms and music. And, for instance, one of his practiced techniques, he discovered early that he could rouse the crowd better by arriving from behind the crowd, walking through the crowd up the aisle to the stage, rather than the traditional way of coming from behind the stage through the curtain to the podium. This was one of Hitler's techniques that worked.
Yeah. You know, I wanted to ask you whether you saw any of Hitler's techniques in modern politics, but I don't, of course, want to put you in the position or get myself in the position of comparing American political candidates to Hitler, or calling them Nazis or anything like that. But I'm wondering, are these sort of tried and true techniques, dumbing down the message, using nationalism to divide people, are these strategies you see from time to time?
From time to time. And, no politician really is innocent of having appealed to mass emotion.
Right. That's
sort of the name of the game. It just is a question of how far you go and which emotions you appeal to. Comparisons have been made, of course.
Yeah.
I think you have to be careful about going too far with those.
Yeah.
But surely the notion of a country in trouble looking for a strong man does have a certain resonance.
Well, let's talk about that putsch, because this was gets us started to talk about this critical time. And let's talk about the details of that night. This was on the evening of November 8th, 1923. Adolf Hitler, as you point out in your book, is 34 years old. Tell us the story. He has three bodyguards with him, and he's holding a pistol in one hand as he walks into this beer hall. He's got these wide eyes, looking something like a drunken fanatic, is how you put it. Tell the story.
Yes,
what happens?
I was quoting somebody else as describing him looking that
right,
way
right,
as he
right.
walked in. The adrenaline was clearly pumping. Hitler had arrived at this point for political reasons, and he decided he had to take hostage the three men who were running Bavaria at that point. They were all at the meeting in the beer hall. It was a meeting. It was not a drunken brawl. Beer
right.
halls were common community centers as well as drinking places in Munich and Bavaria at that time. He comes in with his pistol. There are 3,000 people present. He shouts for quiet, and nobody can hear him. So he stands up on a chair and shoots into the ceiling, and that got everybody's attention. He announced that the National Revolution has broken out and that the Bavarian and the national governments are both deposed, and that he's taking the leadership into a side room for a few minutes to discuss matters, and that everybody should remain calm, and that the beer hall itself was surrounded by 600 heavily armed men. That's how it began.
Right. He says the place is surrounded. There's no getting out. And essentially, it's a captive audience in many ways.
Quite literally.
Yeah.
Hermann Göring, whom we hear from later in the Third Reich, of course, and he became number two, Hermann Göring was an ex-captain in the German Luftwaffe in the Air Force, and he was there with a machine gun platoon right behind Hitler, backing him up at the entrance. He took over as Hitler left the room, and he stood up and fired his pistol into the ceiling and said, "Everybody be quiet, and after all, you've got your beer. What do you have to complain about?"
Right. Well, of course,
it
worked, yeah. But in the end, of course, it doesn't go so well. 15 of his men are killed. 4 police troopers also killed. And 2 days later, he's captured. I guess he's sort of, he was at a friend's villa when they found him finally.
That's right. He escaped the bloodshed on the day after the putsch began in the center of Munich, made it to a friend's villa outside Munich, and 2 days later was found by the police there and was hauled off to Landsberg prison.
What was the effect of that failed putsch on Hitler at first? Because you say in the book because this seemed like a critical moment to me. You say that at this particular moment, by many, he was kind of dismissed as an extremist clown. He manages to change that impression, but this seems like a real turning point. He could have been dismissed out of hand at this point.
Absolutely, and he dismissed himself at that point.
He
was flat on his back. His putsch had gone awry. 15 of his men plus 1 bystander and 4 policemen had been killed. Hitler had avoided being killed by only about 2 feet. The man next to him was killed. And as he fell, he flung Hitler to the pavement, and Hitler had a badly dislocated shoulder, very painful. Hitler was so depressed, and he said, "I think it's all over. I can't go on. The German people don't want me." He went into a hunger strike.
Right.
He tried to. He had threatened suicide often before. He was a man of extremes. He only saw 2 possibilities in many situations. One was victory, and the other was death. Nothing in between. So, in prison, he had no pistol and no way to threaten suicide. So he decided to do it by starvation. And the hunger strike lasted about 10 days before people talked him out of it.
When do things start to turn? Because he's, in some way, as you said, and as I mentioned in the introduction, in your book, it was the best thing that really happens to him, because he has to settle in. He has to brood and sit there and think, and it really changed his strategic vision. That's how you put it in the book. Let's talk about that.
Yes, this was a clarifying process, these 13 months in prison. Once he came out of the hunger strike, he began thinking about his future. He began writing things down, and he began regaining his confidence. And he began preparing for his treason trial, which came 3 months later and lasted for a month. And by the time he went on trial, he was ready to be the old Hitler again, and made 2 major speeches, one on the first day, one on the last day of hearings, and they went on for up to 4 hours,
right,
and took the place by storm, more or less. And the judge couldn't stop him, he claimed. Hitler felt all of his juices flowing again, and made all kinds of grand statements about the future of Germany, and saying, "Even if we go to prison, history will judge us not guilty, and the heroes of our moment." So he was very histrionic and very full of himself by that time.
Place was packed with journalists, too. A lot of attention being paid to the trial.
That's right. The courtroom had been configured from an old officer's school, 120 seats in this room, and 60 of them were delegated to the press. And there was a press overflow room down the hall, which was constantly filled. So Hitler was able to put the Nazi brand into circulation nationally in a way he had never been able to do before. The Nazis were regarded as a Bavarian phenomenon, largely. Now everybody in Germany knew who they were, and it had a galvanizing effect on lots of folks, most notably a young man about 400 miles away in a small northwest German industrial town. His name was Joseph Goebbels.
Yeah. Let's talk about the verdict. It's interesting. You've described the scene of the place is packed again. There's a lot of, as you describe it, anxious anticipation and kind of restrained jubilation, despite the fact that he's convicted. And the verdict pretty light. I guess that's an understatement. He didn't get much for being indicted.
That's right. I mean, this was a
high treason, by the way.
Exactly. Yeah. He could have gotten up to life,
yeah.
But he got the minimum, which was 5 years, with the promise of parole in 6 months if he maintained good behavior, which he did, more or less. But in the courtroom that day, I mean, he had a large following among women who showed up with flowers and pastries, cakes for him as gifts. There was a large contingent of people outside the building, and he opened a window and waved to them like a conquering hero. This was a man who was about to be taken back to prison to serve a 5-year sentence. But it was, even though it was a legal loss, it was a political victory for Hitler.
I don't know what to make of the judge. The judge admitted that what they had done was wrong, but he said they had good intentions or that they meant well. And he said he had noble, unselfish motives. They acted in a purely patriotic spirit. What was that about?
Well, there was a precedent for that. He had already, this same judge 2 years earlier, had already given a form of clemency to a man who had killed the sitting prime minister of Bavaria, murdered him on a sidewalk, and gotten a death sentence. And this judge came along and lifted the death sentence and gave him so-called honorable imprisonment,
right.
Which meant he was treated light. It was light imprisonment with good conditions and good food and not much work. And he did this because of he claimed that the murderer had a glowing love of his fatherland. So this judge, George Neidhart, was a very nationalistic guy, right-leaning fellow, which was not uncommon in Bavaria at that time, who thought that the right political spirit overcame the law,
yeah.
In effect. And he did more or less the same thing with Hitler.
No long prison time, no appeal. And let's talk about deportation, because technically, according to German law, if you're a foreigner who commits treason, you're supposed to be deported, you know, back to
That's
Austria
right.
in Hitler's case. And this is the thing that Hitler worried about almost more than anything, you say.
That's correct. That could have happened. He knew what to worry about. And under a 1922 law called the Law for the Protection of the Republic, any foreigner who did what he did was supposed to be deported regardless of what the outcome of the trial was. Even if he had been pronounced innocent, he still should have been deported. But the judge also addressed that and said that this article of the law should not be applied to Adolf Hitler because of two things. One, he had served four and a half years in the German army during World War I.
Right.
He was a volunteer. And two, he considered himself to be a German, not an Austrian. I mean,
right.
Hitler had made a very big deal of his nationalistic sentiments and his Germanness from an early stage, and that was a convincing, mitigating factor for the judge.
After the trial, after that, you know, burst of cheers and everything, he, as you say, they have to return him to Landsberg Prison, where he's going to spend, you know, the rest of this time, 6 months, I guess it ends up being. And you say Hitler goes back on top of the world. He has this new energy, and it was, as you put it in your book, one of the most productive times of his life. Talk about that, if you
That's
will.
Right. It's not clear exactly when he decided to write the book, but somewhere in this period he was clearly thinking about it. He was asked to write a long article for a very nationalistic magazine called Deutschlands Erneuerung. Mm. He wrote this piece right after coming out of prison, maybe even partially before coming out of prison. It was a big success, and it became the basis in many ways for parts of Mein Kampf. And within a month, he had begun throwing himself into the writing of Mein Kampf. You know, this came partly out of his wanderings in the garden, talking politics with other guys. He kind of had a period, I think, of the 40 days in the wilderness. That's mm-hmm. sort of what prison was like for him. He wasn't used to having that sort of time on his hands. And so he turned all that energy, which had formerly been used in running around, sometimes making up to 10 speeches in one day during the revolutionary period leading up to the putsch. He turned that energy into working on this book. He would start at 5 in the morning. One of his cellmates prison mates, Rudolf Hess, would bring him tea at 5 in the morning and sometimes work as late as midnight.
He didn't dictate to Hess. I mean, that was one idea that people thought, that Hitler was just dictating these words to Rudolf Hess. That he had a typewriter, a little portable Remington.
That's right. This is one of the diehard legends that's been out there for a long time, but recent scholarship has shown that that was not the case. Hitler wrote it himself. He got this typewriter as a gift from one of the rich women who was a big fan of his. He had several of these. And ironically, this typewriter had been manufactured just the month before in New York. The serial number proved that. Wow. And it was a gift to Hitler. There's a picture of it in my book. And he wrote the first volume of Mein Kampf, 380 or 90 pages, on that typewriter.
Well, when we get back from a break, we'll talk about what was in Mein Kampf. Peter Ross Range is with us. His book is called 1924, The Year That Made Hitler. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about Adolf Hitler's rambling, narcissistic, delusional manifesto, Mein Kampf. Of course, he wrote it while in prison for trying to overthrow the German government. We've been talking about that. And it was a book, that book and that year, that really solidified his vision and his plan. Peter Ross Range says it changed the trajectory of his life and, of course, history as well. Ross Range has written a book called The Year That Made Hitler, 1924, The Year That Made Hitler, and he's joining us today to talk about it. So I think it's interesting, all the theories about why it is, in fact, that he wrote the book. I mean, beyond his sense of needing to make this grand statement, you also say it could have been that he needed the money, and there's some sense that people were urging him to sort of shut him up.
Yeah, there's only one source who says that,
right.
An important source, however. I take that as a kind of a funny story that may or may not be true. The part about the money is true.
Yeah.
He wrote a letter saying, my lawyer's bills make my hair stand on end. Hitler had never had a real job except being a private in the army, so this money was a serious concern for him. In the end, however, I think it was his messianic megalomania that drove him to want to write the book. And his need to preach to large numbers of people as, a coming Messiah in his own eyes. In prison, he did have 40 prison mates from the putsch whom he could talk to over dinner at night. And talk to is the operative word. His idea of a conversation was a monologue by him that could go on forever. But 40 is not enough. He needed to reach he was used to speaking to beer halls and large arenas with up to 6,000 people. So, plus he needed to work out what he thought was his worldview or an ideology or lay out in complex, highly rationalized and justified forms the basic plan that he had in mind, which was the anti-Semitic part, getting rid of Jews, and the Lebensraum part, the living space, which involved conquest in Russia.
Those were critical themes for him. He believed that, you say, that the highest goal of government was not just keeping the peace, it was preserving and critically expanding your own people. So this idea of living space, this was sort of baked into the way he saw what a country was about. Does that mean conquest? That was part of the plan?
Yes. He had even in speeches before he wrote Mein Kampf talked about getting land and soil in the East. And he had an elaborate explanation of why Germany should never have gotten into the colonial business before World War I, competing with France and Britain and for overseas colonies, but rather should do what he called land colonization, which could only come at the cost of Russia, he said.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting, his sense of beyond race and nationalism, obviously those themes, he was really preoccupied with international alliances. So who did he see coming together? Who was the enemy? France was the enemy. It was the sort of a deep enemy to Germany. He saw that. But how did he see England and how did he see Russia? Because it seems like what you were saying in the book was he was trying to figure out which to pick as an ally and which to pick as an enemy.
Yeah, that's right. Here this guy, a former private in the Army, is sitting in a prison cell moving pieces around the world chessboard as though he owned, owned the world. And he contemplated what it would be like if Germany were allied with England, were allied with Italy, or even with Russia. But he quickly dismissed the notion of a Russian alliance against the British and preferred the idea of a British alliance against the Russians. And he always had Italy in play in his mind, too, and wanted to be allied with Italy, which, in fact, is what happened. The notion of somehow or other being allied with Britain against Russia, of course, never happened, never even came close. The Russian thing in the end was a very strange business with Hitler striking a pact with Stalin right at the beginning of World War I, but then 2 years later invading Russia. But Hitler was, spilled a great deal of ink over these topics in writing Mein Kampf.
Do you think it's interesting when you look at Hitler, his ability to sort of mesmerize masses of people. That was in his posing and the way he spoke. But it doesn't seem to have translated into his writing. It was a different kind of... He wasn't as persuasive as a writer. I have to say, reading the book as I've been a little bit over the last little while, it's rambling. It goes off on... I mean, it doesn't seem terribly compelling in many ways.
That's right. It is very confusing and hard to put together the story he's trying to lay out there and the worldview he's trying to lay out. And everybody, the experts and the scholars, they all complain about it. And that's why they're working so hard to put together books like this new version in Germany, which helps you understand all of that. But Hitler himself in Mein Kampf talks about the power of the spoken word versus the written word. No great revolution has been caused by a book, he claims. And no great leader has emerged from his writing, but rather from his speaking. And he's saying this even as he's writing a book. And it is true that once it was out there, the book didn't have anything like the impact that, say, four or five of Hitler's big speeches would have. It was the first 10,000 copies were bought in about 6 months, which is a good sale, but it was mostly to the true believers themselves. The second volume was published, and it sold very slowly. And it was not really until almost 1930 when the Nazis finally, as the Depression sank in, the Nazis began succeeding a lot more and became the second biggest party in Germany, that the book sales really took off.
Yeah. I guess you had to if you were in the party or if you wanted to seem loyal. It probably looked good to have Mein Kampf on your shelf, probably, I guess.
This is an interesting point you're making, and it's a subject of great debate among the scholars, because another legend has grown up over the years that Hitler's book was unreadable and unread. It gained a reputation of being the world's biggest unread bestseller. It sold more than 12 million copies before Hitler died. That has also, I think, been largely disproved by recent scholarship, for instance, by studying public library lending records. It's been established that plenty of people willingly and happily went to get the book to read it, and that it wasn't simply window dressing. Even though a lot of people were given the book as a wedding gift, by no means everybody, by the way.
Yeah.
That whole program sort of functioned about 50% of the time. It is now considered the case that it was much more widely read than has been heretofore believed, and was not just something that a party member had to have on his desk or claimed to have read. And then there are, on the other side of the coin, plenty of stories of party members saying somewhere along the line, geez, I tried to read that thing and I just couldn't get through it.
Yeah.
You know, kind of following the line that you mentioned a minute ago about how rambling and digressive and impenetrable it is sometimes.
Let's talk about race. There's a kind of chilling section that he calls Nation and Race, a chapter there. And it's interesting, let me read this beginning little sentence here. He says, there are some truths which are so obvious that for this very reason they are not seen or at least not recognized by ordinary people, which kind of gets at a sort of a technique that he uses. He doesn't really make his arguments very well. He's just saying all this stuff is just obvious. It's not really an argument that he's making. He's just making declarations, it seems.
Very good point on two points. Number one, that chapter, Race and Nation, I sometimes mix up my German and my English, is probably the most important chapter out of 27 chapters in the two volumes of Mein Kampf.
Yeah.
And number two, you're absolutely right. He speaks in the omniscient voice throughout this book. He doesn't bother to build up an argument. He just states things as flat truths in sort of an oracular, godlike voice, the same way he made speeches, by the way. And critics of his writing in Germany, in German, have pointed out that one reason his writing is so bad is that he wrote like he spoke. Two things that don't translate very well sometimes. But you're right. And Hitler did not bother, not only did he not bother to provide sources, and all of his thinking, by the way, was derivative. I mean, all of the racist and racial theories social Darwinism, all of that was in circulation intellectually in Central Europe starting in 1850, 1860. And Hitler's version of that, his own sort of amalgamated pastiche of these ideas, all came from somewhere else. He didn't bother to tell us where anything came from. He attributed almost nothing to any other writer or scholar. The book contains zero footnotes. As you said, he doesn't try to build up an argument. He just states flat truths in his mind.
Let me read another part here. He says, he writes, any crossing of two beings not at exactly the same level, intermarriage is what he's getting at there, of course, produces a medium between the level of the two parents. This means the offspring will probably stand higher than the racially lower parent, but not as high as the higher one. And he goes off on this. What was his sense of racial purity? How did that, the idea of intermixing, I mean, because he really sort of just goes off in this section.
That's right. The racial theories were the absolute heart of Hitler's worldview.
Yeah.
And he uses very crude analogies drawn from social Darwinism of the time about animals. You know, a tiger is a tiger, a wolf is a wolf, and if you mix them, you get a bad result. And he tried to apply that, you know, to such things as Jews and Germans. And he tried to divide all the races and all the nationalities in the world into categories of races. Mm. All of life, in his view, was racial struggle. It was all about race. And the duty of a nation, the job of a government, was to protect its own racial purity, protect its own blood, and to enhance it through all kinds of ideas of all kinds of programs for racial purity, like, as we know, birth rate programs. You know, Hitler, when he got to power, promoted more births among German women and even had a place called Lebensborn where German women were sent just to have babies. And and the opposite side of that coin, of course, was getting rid of Jews.
All great cultures of the past, he writes, perished only because the originally creative race died out from blood poisoning.
And right. He divided all the races in the world into three groups, culture creative, culture bearing, and culture destroying.
Yeah.
The Germans and the Aryans were culture creators. The Japanese, he always said, were the culture bearers, meaning they were sort of in the middle and sort of didn't do anything one way or the other. They didn't create new cultures, but they didn't destroy them. And the Jews were the ultimate culture destroyers. That was Hitler's typology.
The Jewish people, he writes, despite all apparent intellectual qualities, is without any true culture, and especially without any culture of its own. Which is, of course, preposterous. I don't even know where he's coming from with that. But that was an important point for him, the idea that the Germans, the Aryans, had true culture. The Jews were intent on destroying culture, I guess. That's the idea, right?
Yeah, this is one of the hardest parts of the whole Hitlerian worldview to grasp, given the role that Jews already played in German culture. It has been pointed out and argued in many cases that Jews were, in fact, the main supporters and patrons of German culture, high culture, as we knew it at that time. And it was probably the highest culture in the world. But he dwelled on two things. One was the historic lack of a homeland in the previous 2,000 years for Jews, and so that there were always a minority in some other host nation, and he liked to refer to them as parasites on the host nation. And one of the other driving factors, besides the existing cultural elites and business and scientific elites in Germany and Austria among Jews, there was, of course, the wave of uneducated, very poor Jews who had come from the East over the past 4 or 5 decades, driven out of Russia and the East by the pogroms. Mm. And this was, of course, a group that was very different from the established bourgeois culture in these Central European cities of Berlin and Vienna, for example. He was able to play on whatever foibles people perceived them to have. For instance, they were thought to have been perpetrators of prostitution, right, and sellers of shoddy goods and thieves and dirty and smelled bad and all these other things. He played it. He dwelt on those qualities whenever he could.
He writes this. With that, he said the... without the possibility of using lower human beings, the Aryan would never have been able to take his first steps toward his future culture. What does he mean by that? The idea of using other lesser races, I suppose, as chattel, that they were just a means of slave labor, in essence, to accomplish the great task of the great Aryan, I suppose.
That's right. This fits into his image of the perpetual struggle among the races, and that the weak are supposed to be driven out by the strong. The strong are supposed to succeed, and they will fail only if they are so stupid as to mix with these others, which is what he was accusing Germans of having done by letting Jews become important players in their society and using that argument to argue for getting rid of them.
Now, it's important to say Hitler is not in Mein Kampf explicit about actually exterminating the Jews. But he does say Germany, would collapse unless they do something about the Jews. I guess he indirectly gets at the point.
Yes. I mean, not the exterminationist part. The most you can say about what he was saying in these years was that he wanted to get rid of Jews. There is the famous or infamous line near the end of Volume 2 where he is talking about the early days of World War I, and his big objection there was that Jews were war profiteers, he claimed, and he even claimed they didn't fight in the war, which is patently untrue. And he said if 12 or 15,000 of these Hebrew corruptors of the people had been held under gas— Yeah. At the beginning of the war, it would have saved 1 million worthy German lives. Some folks have seized on that passage to claim that he already knew that he was going to have gas chambers. Most experts disagree completely. But it did show the lengths to which Hitler's mind was already going, that he could conceive of such a horrible tactic.
Do you think he had in mind a final solution in those days, even if he didn't explicitly express it? Was he thinking mostly deportation at the time, or was he thinking we'll kill them eventually? Do you know? Any way of knowing, I guess?
Well, I judge it by what the people who have studied this all their lives say. I come out of journalism originally, and so I have great respect for lifetime academics. And I've not found any of them who thinks that Hitler already conceived of extermination at that point as the solution. Deportation, moving them around, maybe even putting them somewhere in Eastern Europe. Eventually, they talked about Madagascar as a destination for the Jews. But just simply, they had to be gotten rid of. And it was mostly meaning physically out of the way, not physically dead.
Peter Ross Range is with us. His book is 1924, The Year That Made Hitler. We need to take a quick break, and we'll come back for some final thoughts in just a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with the journalist Peter Ross Range. We're talking about his book, 1924, The Year That Made Hitler. He's joining us from a studio in Washington, D.C. So there was a kind of a small bidding war for this book when the process of being written. But he settles with a Nazi publisher, not from the Nazi publishing house. Max Amann, is that the man?
That's right.
Yeah.
Max Amann, ironically, had been Hitler's sergeant in World War I. Hitler never got beyond private first class. But then he became one of Hitler's followers politically, and he had a good business touch. He was not a good political guy or a good speaker, but he had a good business touch. And somehow convinced Hitler, or Hitler convinced himself, that he should go with Amann's publishing house, which was very, very close to the party, rather than take offers from two other publishers who were trying to get him. One of them came and visited him 5 or 6 times in 1 month, in his first month after the trial, to try to get his book. And Hitler's decision probably was the right one from a purely selfish point of view, because it made him a very rich man in the end.
Yeah. 12 million copies ultimately it sold. And that money went mostly to him, went to his pocket, and I guess a bulk of it anyway.
And to the publisher. Yeah, it's pretty much the same as things are today. Best I can figure, he got roughly a 10% royalty. I think the publisher got another 10 or 15%, and the rest were overhead and costs. But there were times when that book was being sold almost 1 million per year. In fact, in 1933, it did sell 1 million. Mm-hmm. And they had to enlist half a dozen different printeries to get the book out.
The reviews of the book, you say, reflected, I guess, the ideology or the beliefs of the person who was reviewing it. The right-wingers loved it. Hitler's critics, of course, didn't. In fact, you say that one even believed that the book, you know, when he read it, he said, this is the end of Adolf Hitler. This is going to undo him.
Exactly. That was in the Frankfurter Zeitung, the Frankfurt newspaper, one of the leading high-quality, sophisticated newspapers in Germany at that time. And this was no review. The review was several pages long. And at the end, the man said, based on this book, Hitler is erledigt, which means finished in German in this context. And that was the prevailing view among sophisticates, you know, to their everlasting sorrow later.
Yeah. I was baffled by the fact, and I hadn't realized this, that the original manuscript for the book is lost. But the manuscript in some way was sort of treated, as you say, as a state secret. Hitler refused to allow it to be displayed. He didn't want it photographed. What was the mystery about the manuscript?
That is unclear. Huh. All the historians would like to know the answer to that. All we know for sure is that at a party congress in about 1934-35, one of the organizers asked for a copy of the several pages of a copy of the original manuscript to be put into an exhibit so that the party faithful who were coming to Nuremberg for the usual hoopla could walk in great awe past some glass cases showing these pages, and Hitler refused. The letter was not written by him but by somebody else, who said the Führer has decided not to do this. So we really don't know. Much later, only in the last decade, several pages, which are thought to be the first 5 pages of Mein Kampf, have been discovered. And these were pages written in the prison. The typeface and the typewriter characteristics have been compared by forensic specialists. So we know they're the real thing. And they had been uncovered in the ruins of Hitler's mountain retreat in Berchtesgaden after the war, taken by French soldiers, somehow ended up in American hands, and then didn't surface to the point that scholars could see them until about 2005, I believe. And even now, these are privately held by an American collector whose name is unknown. The scholars got their look, and now they're, you know, they don't have them anymore. So this is all we've got, is those 5 pages. But I don't consider it, frankly, a great loss as a researcher, because the manuscript changed a lot for a while there. I mean, 6 or 8 people were involved in editing it after it came out, after Hitler came out of prison. It took 6 months for the first volume to be published. New material was thought up and stuck in from time to time. There are places where the writing all of a sudden gets better, which suggests that somebody besides Hitler wrote in some paragraphs.
Right.
And so what matters really is having the first edition, which was published in 1925 and second volume in 1926. And that's the edition that is used in this annotated version that the Germans published.
2,000 pages. Extremely annotated, I guess.
Yes, yeah. It looks, you know, I've got it in front of me as we speak, Doug. It looks like a Talmud, to be honest. Each volume is the size of an Encyclopedia Britannica volume or an old Bible full of annotations. Anybody who knows what an old Jewish Bible or a Talmud looks like knows that it's full of commentary, more commentary than the main text, the biblical text. Same thing in this case. Hitler's words are on the right-hand page, and down one column beside it are notations of all the textual variations in subsequent editions of Mein Kampf. And then on the left-hand page are three or four columns of footnotes, and they keep running underneath the original text. So the original text in this new version is sort of surrounded by footnotes, and this was part of the strategy of the scholars in Munich who did this book over a seven-year period. They wanted to sort of surround and encircle Hitler, almost like you would in a military campaign, and deconstruct, demystify, and defang this evil book.
Final question, less than a minute. One of the things that people have worried about is that hate groups are going to start drawing inspiration from Mein Kampf once it's, you know, now republished. Do you think the book has the same kind of appeal it would have had? I mean, of course, the context is different, but does it translate at all into a modern context? Is it anything other than a relic? You know what I mean?
It is a relic, and the answer is no. It is full of references to events in the 20s that the average reader can't understand. You don't hear, neo-Nazis giving elaborate explanations of Mein Kampf. They quote a few lines here and there. And of course, they can get it on the Internet for free any day anyway,
right,
and have been able to do that for 20 years. And this particular version is kind of hard to read, I have to say, as a guy who's read it twice, once in German, once in English, and who is now going through it reading these footnotes. It's slow. It's tough. It's not fun. It's scholarly work. And I can't imagine any self-respecting neo-Nazi spending time with this.
It's Peter Ross Range. His book is 1924, The Year That Made Hitler. He joined us from a studio in Washington. Peter, thanks very much for the time.
Thank you, Doug.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.